From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. 40 years ago today, the Supreme Court ruled that school segregation was unconstitutional. On today's Fresh Air, Melba Beals remembers the vicious confrontation which took place when she and 8 other black students attempted to integrate Little Rock Central High. They were met by angry mobs while the Arkansas National Guard barred them from entering the building. Also, we talk with Michael Doris about writing and about raising his adopted children, 3 of whom were diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome. Doris's new book, Paper Trail, is a collection of his writings. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Major banks are raising their prime lending rates 0.5 percentage point. Citibank for Chicago and Bank of New York have raised their primes to 7.25%. They acted shortly after the Federal Reserve announced today it's raising 2 of its key lending rates to control inflation. That move had been widely expected. The U.S. Attorney General is lobbying Congress to include extensive crime prevention programs in anti-crime legislation. UPI's Carol Van Dam has this report.
Utah Senator Orrin Hatch, the ranking Republican on the committee, says billions of dollars in grants for local government crime prevention programs as proposed in the House crime bill amount to nothing more than rewarding tax-happy cities, which have done a poor job of governing. To that, Attorney General Reno replied, Salt Lake City, Hatch's hometown, is one of those cities where federal grant programs are working.
We see so many programs working in the country. Others could work better if they had the monies.
Reno strongly supports the so-called ounce of prevention programs and other crime prevention initiatives aimed at kids who are home alone and bored. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
Amtrak says rail traffic has returned to normal today after a train derailed yesterday in North Carolina. The cause of the crash near Smithfield is still being checked out. But officials say a semi-trailer that was on a passing freight train had shifted into the path of Amtrak's southbound Silver Meteor train. The collision killed one engineer and hurt more than 350 people. All but one car came off the tracks. Forces who back the longtime elderly president of the Dominican Republic say he's won his 7th term in office, but votes are still being counted, and opposition officials say the balloting was fraudulent. NPR's David Wilner reports from Santo Domingo.
The supporters of Dominican President Joaquin Balaguer admit the voting was very close, but with 2/3 of the votes counted, they project they'll come out on top by about 2 percentage points. But yesterday's voting was plagued by problems. Many voters found that despite having voting credentials, their names did not appear on voter registration lists at the polls, which prevented them from voting. International observers say it seems most of those who could not vote favored opposition candidates. Supporters of José Francisco Peña Gómez, who was the favorite to win the election, charge his victory is being stolen by the aging anti-communist president. President Balaguer's running mate said today the president is unlikely to tighten controls on the border to keep contraband from entering Haiti, where a full trade embargo is to take effect Saturday. I'm David Walna in Santo Domingo.
The United Nations Security Council has voted to send more than 5,000 peacekeepers to Rwanda. The council has also imposed a worldwide arms embargo against the tiny nation. The peacekeeping force will be all African. It's being asked to protect civilians and relief workers in areas where relief supplies are getting through. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 44 points. This is NPR. Heavy fighting is continuing around a military base in southern Yemen. Northern and southern Yemeni troops are battling each other for control of the site. The BBC's Simon Ingram reports from Sana'a.
Sana'a Radio said forces loyal to the president had completed the encirclement of the large southern base of El Anout and were in control of the surrounding area. The radio said the objective was to encourage soldiers inside the base to switch allegiances and join what it termed the forces of legality. Although the number of troops inside El Anout is not known, observers say as many as 20,000 could be there, and the Russian-built base is heavily fortified. Seizing El Anout by force would be costly in terms of casualties and time, and President Saleh's real objective remains the capture of Aden, 60 kilometers to the south.
The BBC's the Simon Ingram reporting. Arab gunmen shot and killed two Israeli settlers in a car today near the West Bank town of Hebron. A third passenger was wounded. This comes after Jewish settlers shot at least 18 Palestinians yesterday as they walked through Hebron. Israeli radio says some Israeli cabinet ministers are calling the settlers' walk through the town provocative, and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin is calling the settlers' shooting unjustified. But Israel's military chief of staff says the settlers had a right to rather walk through Hebron. Palestinian journalists are reporting the shooting of a Palestinian man in the West Bank town of Nablus. They say Israeli soldiers shot him after their vehicle was stoned. The Clinton administration has developed a new plan to combat homelessness. The Interagency Task Force on the Homeless is offering a $1.7 billion plan to get the homeless into homes of their own. It recommends moving homeless people from short-term emergency shelters to transitional housing. Then they would be moved to affordable, permanent homes and receive counseling and job training. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Today marks the 40th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, the Supreme Court ruling that brought an end to the legal segregation of the nation's public schools. This ruling changed the law, but actual integration didn't always go so smoothly. 3 years after the Brown decision, 9 black students were chosen to attend the all-white Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. Not only were many white citizens violently opposed to it, but Arkansas's governor, Orville Faubus, called out the Arkansas National Guard to prevent the black students from entering the school. It wasn't until President Eisenhower sent in the 101st Airborne 2 weeks later that they were able to start classes at the school. Melba Beals was one of those black students. She's written a memoir called Warriors Don't Cry about her junior year at Central High. Beals was 13 when the Brown versus the Board of Education ruling was issued. She told me her teacher sent the students home early that day for fear of reprisals.
On that day, I was walking home from school, and I always walked across this persimmon field. It was a field where these mushy persimmons were, and it was kind of like a vacant lot in the neighborhood that I lived in. And I was walking across the field, and this man approached, and he's, you know, I first hear this voice at the end, and he's there, and he makes an effort to rape me. And the only way I got away was because one of the older girls, who had up to that time really tortured me, came through that field, or came that way, and rescued me by hitting him on the back of the head and on the back.
And this was a white man.
Yes, it was. And he said, you know, as he was doing this, he said, I'll teach you people to want to go to school with my kids. You can't do that. You can't be free. You can't do this. You know, and those nigger-loving Supreme Court judges, I'll show them. So he was just really vile, and it was because of the Brown versus Topeka decision. And you know, as a result of that, I decided that I was going to spend a nickel and read the newspaper all the time so that I could keep up with what was going on, so that when the white people were angry at me, I would know it and I could do something about it.
You write that by the age of 3, you were already afraid of white people.
Sure. Describe
the racial climate in Little Rock, Arkansas. We're talking about the 40s and the 50s.
Really frightening. The thing that struck me was that a lot of the adults always talked about white people and what they wanted and what they thought they should do to make it all right. And a few years just before that, there had been a man who'd been hanged in our church. And so I was really frightened of the talk. Just the talk made me uneasy. And then when we would go out like downtown, out of our own little reservation, it was the encounters. We'd be walking down a path, and my mother would have to step aside. And we would always keep our head lowered. Mother would always say, "Don't look up. Don't look up," you know, and that's frightened me. And I just felt that they were the boss, that they had all the power, that I couldn't do anything, that there was no way out for me, that I didn't possess any ability to determine what I was going to do.
Now, when you were 16 years old, this was after Brown versus the Board of Education, and a teacher in your school said, "How many of you would like to go to Central High School in Little Rock, an all-white school?" You raised your hand. Why?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, my mother had been one of the first blacks to go to the University of Arkansas. And that had been a very trying experience. So I want to say right off the bat, I understood what it meant to integrate. But mother's trying experience was people frowning. Hers was like kind of chit-chat at the dinner table and heartbreaking stuff, and it made her sad. But in no way did I conceive of any physical violence.
And yet you didn't tell your family.
No.
Why not?
Because, you know, somewhere in me, I knew that this was a stretch, that I was walking across a line that maybe I ought to have consulted them about. But I didn't really ever expect, kind of I expected and kind of I didn't, that it would happen, you know? I mean, for us to get that opportunity to go was like at that point a distant possibility, not anything that was immediate. And so I just kind of mumbled to myself about it. Yes, I ought to go home and tell Grandma, but I didn't. Because then they'd have this big discussion. They might make me take my name off, you know? So I just didn't. And I just thought, you know, okay, I'm going to write my name. Nothing's going to happen.
And their reaction when you did finally tell them?
They were aghast. I mean, as I described, you know, they circled me like covered waggers circling for the attack of the Indians. And they all, you know, jumped on me. And they, you know, what did you do this for? Why didn't you tell us? Are you out of your mind?
They were afraid of for your safety.
It wasn't even that. They had no concept that Little Rock people would be that violent because they had not been really, except for a few hangings now and then, excuse me, they had not been that group violence was not a big thing in Little Rock. They hanged people individually for things that they thought were horrifying up to then. But there wasn't any sign that people got into mobs and did uglies. And the buses had been integrated without a traumatic kind of incident. And so the anticipation was that there would be this short little foray, and then we'd go about our business, you know.
Did you feel, though, that once you decided to integrate Little Rock Central High School, that you had to be perfect, you had to be a model student, even above and beyond the kind of perfection that your family asked from you?
Without question. Because the white people, we were always told they were better than we, and they were smarter than we were. And I remember my friend saying to me, you know, you can't perspire. You can't sweat. Because if you sweat, you know, all white people don't sweat. And a lot of my friends were telling me things I had to do. Everybody, you know, became then the advice giver. Everybody we ran into, whether at church, on the way to the grocery store, at the mailman, everybody we ran into became, don't go to, the, you know, advice giver. Some would say, you know, don't be too uppity now. You can't go to that school. And others would say what I had to do to get along. You got to wear certain clothes. You got to change the look of your hair. I had long hair. I had a ponytail. Gosh, you got to go on a diet. You can't wear those saddle shoes. And, you know, so like my grandmother and mother were sewing like mad. My mother was sewing clothes. And because we were poor, we didn't have a lot of money. And I remember a time when my dressers were made of flour socks bleach. So we didn't have a lot. But Mama was sewing because she could make things. And so we were getting ready for this because we had to be as good as we could be because we've been told all our lives that they were better than we were.
We're speaking today with Melba Beals, and she's written a book called Warriors Don't Cry, and it's about the efforts to integrate Little Rock Central High School, and she was one of the first 9 black students to integrate that school. Tell us then about the first day. This was September 1957. Mm-hmm. You and your mother got in the car, drove up to Little Rock Central High School.
Yeah.
Describe what you saw when you got there.
Well, we first heard the noise walking, approaching it. We heard noise, and we heard there were people walking on the sidewalk towards the school. The gathering, for whatever reason, was there because we were coming, because by that time, white people had begun to make it very clear that they didn't want us to go. But it became clear to me that this was a bigger than I had imagined horror when we walked up behind this mob who was gathering across the street from the school, and their focused attention was on Elizabeth Eckford. And across the street directly in front of Central High School, there were the Arkansas members of the Arkansas National Guard.
And Elizabeth was one of the other students.
She was one. Elizabeth Eckford was one of the 9 students. And she was walking along this ring of guardsmen trying to enter. Because by this time we knew, because of one of our spies, and because I think Mrs. Bates even drove over there the night before, we knew that Vabas had ringed the school with guards. We knew that very well.
He was the governor.
He was the governor of Little Rock, of Arkansas, and we knew that those guards had been dispatched. What we hypothesized was that those guards might be there to keep the peace, to protect the property, to not maybe help us enter, but certainly to keep anybody from getting us as we entered. So when I saw Elizabeth walk this line, and try to get through. And every time she'd try to get through, they would close ranks on her. It was a surprise to me. And it was a horror to me because at first all this attention is focused on her. We're going to hang her, get the nigger, get her. And then as that goes on, we're standing there trying to figure out, well, how do we get to Elizabeth? What do? We can't see anybody else in sight. We couldn't see the other people because later on we would learn they were down at the end of the block, the group, the core of the group. And so my mom and I were talking about what can we do? And we realized we can't do anything. And then it occurred to my mother that if we went over to stand with Elizabeth, we might endanger her more than if we went the other way. So we determined that we were in trouble. We got to get out of here.
Well, I had assumed that the crowd would have figured out why you were there.
Well, sure. But you know, at first it was kind of a milling kind of thing. And they didn't maybe know that we were exactly there for that. At first, their total attention is focused on Elizabeth, who was entering their school. It was the most riveting thing to see this small girl, petite girl, walk this line of armed soldiers, trying to get past them, thinking they're going to let her in at a certain point, believing that maybe she's at the wrong point and should go in at another one, and them closing their ranks every time she made that turn. And at the same time, there begins to collect this crowd on her heels, just sniping at her and growling at her and barking at her, calling her names and reaching out for her. Well, you know, the crowd is at first also riveted by the sight. And the sight of this is churning their anger and churning their rage. And so they're watching her. They're not watching us, really. And only after a little while did a few of the people directly around us say, hey, we don't have to go over there. We got a senator to hang right here.
What happened to Elizabeth that day?
Benjamin Fine, a reporter from the New York Times, a white reporter from the New York Times, and Mrs. Grace Lorch, a white woman, stepped up beside her, even in the midst of that mob, and guided her to the bus and got her out safely. Without them, she'd be dead.
And you and your mother fled back to your car.
We fled back to our car. We got away harried. My mother's blouse was torn. Of course, we're very harried. And the men who were after us with the rope almost did catch us, but for the grace of God, they fell. One guy fell over a limb. The others fell over him. So we were able to make our escape. I in the driver's seat. Mother was in the passenger seat for some unknown reason. She'd been teaching me how to drive in the parking lot at the grocery store as kind of a fluke. We don't know why. But she decided that, I guess, because I was talking about getting my license when I got a little bit older. But I had been practicing intensely, just really yearning to drive. And I knew how to drive then a little bit, not totally. But I was the one who got to the car first. Mother had given me the keys and said, get out of here. Get out of here now. And when I wouldn't go, she slapped me. And I knew we were in trouble because my mother never, ever slapped me ever. Because she said to slap a body was to attack the human spirit. So you never hit somebody in the face for any reason.
Did you have second thoughts that day when you realized what you were truly up against?
Second thoughts does not nearly describe my situation that day. I went home. I get home. My grandmother's pulled all the shades and she's slammed the door. She's got chairs up against the doors because now the black community has heard about this incident. And we get home and grandma's just hysterical and mama's, you know, determined that we're not going to go back. And my father is absolutely adamant. That's it. Pack this kid up and ship her to Cincinnati, Ohio. And
get her out of here.
Get her out of here. And the community now, by then, is up in arms. We can't go anywhere or do anything. And our lives became, we were in a much greater prison than we ever were.
The President of the United States got involved in the standoff in Little Rock.
Well, yes. We go in. It's known as Mob Monday. We go into Central High School and as we are dropped off by members of the NAACP and certain friends, we notice that there's a major mob going on, no, without question. And as we get out of the car, they roar, you know, louder. And we're like equivalent to probably 3/4 of a block distance from them, and maybe half block, going in the side door of Central High School. We get in there, and we can only stay till about 11:30. You know, inside the school, I'm spat upon, kicked, that kind of thing. Some adult mothers are in that school that day. And we are screeched at, but we get to class. And by about 11:30 that day, somebody comes to my class and fetches me to the office and says, we got to get out of there. And while they're collecting us in a room, we hear a man say that the mob is just the school's under siege. And maybe they're going to have to let one of us hang while they get the other 8 out. So, and so that provoked Eisenhower to send, the next day we didn't go to school, of course, and then that provoked by that Wednesday Eisenhower to send the 101st, and he sent the 101st Guard to Little Rock.
So when you marched through the front door, which you did under the watchful eye of the 101st Airborne, did that feel like a victory to you, or was it just too early, too raw to tell?
It was just astounding, you know, because I said, this is why we salute the flag. I am an American. It's going to be okay, you know. This is fine.
Even after all that, you felt...
Hey, you know, we're in here. We're in this front door. This is where none of my people... I say in the book, my favorite sentence is, we walked up to the front door, up to where none of my people had ever been before, a student.
So it did feel like a victory.
Yes. Oh, yes. It felt like, this is it. We've reached our summit. Things are cool.
Melba Beals is our guest today on Fresh Air. Her book is called Warriors Don't Cry, and it's about 1957, when she was 16 years old and in the 11th grade. She was one of nine black students to integrate Little Rock Central High School. Her book is about her experiences and those times. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Melba Beals today and reminiscing about 1957, when she and nine other black students were the first to integrate Little Rock, Arkansas Central High School. Now, you were given a bodyguard, a fella named Danny, and it was his job to stick right by you. He used to stand outside the classrooms and make sure that you got from one class to the next and defend you against the kind of assaults that you took. Tell us, even with a bodyguard, what you had to put up with in the halls and in the classrooms at Central High.
Well, sure. The 101st were told that they could. There were certain parameters around the way they could guard us, and they were told that they were to try and avoid confrontations with those students. And so, you know, there were committees of kids who get together. Today, my left heel is injured from their getting together and walking on my heels. And you just couldn't get rid of them.
Speed and they would walk behind you, right?
They walked directly behind you. Speed it up, they speed it up. And they were good. They'd trade off. And it was just a killer, you know, because I'd go home with skinned heels and they'd get my bone and they'd kick you in the shin bone and the stomach, knock you over, knock you down flights of stairs, throw sticks of dynamite at you.
Which they did. They threw at you.
Yeah, right? Put stuff in your seat to sit on. Acid in my eye, acid-like substance in my eye, which burned my clothes, and I ended up having to wear glasses as a result of that right then. And the main thing was the absolute degradation of my human spirit, to have me sit in a room at 15, to talk all around me, but not to talk to me. You know, one of the things about being in Central High School as a black person was I was lonely, very, very lonely. Days went by when I would like for somebody just to say to me, hi, how are you? Just talk to me. There'd be hours that I wouldn't say anything to anybody. And they'd have like pep rallies and they'd be pounding. And sometimes I would applaud and I would try to get the rhythm of what they were doing. And they would be so ugly about it, you know. If I happened to look somebody in the eye or happened to smile about a joke that I heard or something that was said, they'd be abusive about that. You know, they'd turn and say, what are you talking about, nigger? What are you doing? So there was that kind of constant and continuous attack of my human spirit.
Well, now, did your mother and your grandmother, who you lived with, did they know that every day for you was like going to battle?
Or did you? Not really. They did not know the depth and breadth of what was going on. They didn't totally understand. They knew it was really difficult by the change in my demeanor. And they knew it was hard. My grandmother especially. At one point in the book, I write about going to my grandmother and telling her, you know, I kind of want to die. Mm-hmm. But it was like a kind of. I didn't like actually have it figured out that I was going to commit suicide. I just wanted to die. I thought maybe I could bargain with God and go to sleep for a while and wake up in the summer. And my grandmother was wonderful because she looked at me and she said, good idea.
You know, she did.
Great idea. How'd you plan to do it? And then she turned back. She kept dusting the dining room table, you know. And she was so matter of fact. She said, now, I can just see this headline now, you know. The white folks will have a big party in Robinson Auditorium and celebrate. And it'll be a big headline that you failed to complete your task, you know. And, I mean, she really sobered me up with her her talk about what I thought I wanted to do. So I couldn't tell my mother and my grandmother the real truth. I couldn't even verbalize the real truth until I was an adult. I could not verbalize the total truth until I wrote this book. I couldn't tell anybody how I felt. Only the other 8 people who were there really knows how I felt. And they, I've talked to a couple of them who are really pleased that finally the true story came out, because the white people who were in charge painted a different picture. Oh, it's a little inconvenient for them, but they're getting along just fine.
Melba Beals is our guest. Her book is called Warriors Don't Cry, and it's about her attempts and her success in integrating Little Rock Central High School. She was one of the first 9 black students to integrate that particular high school. Now, you had one more year at Central High, 1958.
Well, in the spring, in the September of 1958, Governor Orval Faubus closed the schools.
For how long?
For a year.
For a whole year.
Until we could go through the courts again. So I'm stuck at home by myself. In that year, in October of that year, my grandmother, who is absolutely my heart, dies. Who had been my pal, my partner through this whole thing, dies very suddenly of leukemia. I'm at home by myself. My mother's going to school. We are now pariahs in the black community, because as he's closing the schools, the white people who wanted segregation are also squeezing the life out of the black community, taking away businesses, denying loans, hitting suppliers, firing maids who worked in hotels, firing maids who worked in their kitchens, doing everything they could to convince us that it would be best not to go back.
So how did you get a senior year of high school?
At the end of that year, the NAACP, we were having trouble. We couldn't go out because we were threatened physically. And at the end of that year, we had repeatedly seen flyers, and we'd heard rumors that the Ku Klux Klan was offering 10,000 dead and 5,000 alive, which was kind of an incentive in 1957. That was a lot of money. And in Little Rock, it was a lot more money. So the NAACP sent out word that they wanted safe houses or homes for all of us to go to. And so we packed our bags, and Ernie was already in Michigan State, and we went 8 different ways. I came to California, and the others went all the other cities that they went to. We were taken in by families. I was fortunate enough to be taken in by Dr. and Mrs. George McCabe, Carol and George, Mom and Pop, who live in Montgomery, California. That's a town not far from San Francisco, about 45 minutes from San Francisco, near Santa Rosa. He was a psychology professor at San Francisco State University. So here, God gave me this incredible blessing, because these people were phenomenal.
You finished high school in California
with
this white family. Mm-hmm. How, when you think back about what happened in Little Rock and what happened in 1957, how do you think about those times now?
With pain. Less pain since I've written the book. The book writing was cathartic for me, because I cried for a couple years, and that got the pain out. Up to then, I'd been, you know, it was sort of in concrete in my soul, in my gut. And I was sort of pretending that everything was okay, and it wasn't at all okay. And the pain was definitely there. And when I think back on Little Rock now, I can think back to that time with a much clearer view, with love. It was an incident which would shape the whole rest of my life.
Well, on that note, I thank you very much, Melba Beals, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Melba Beals' memoir about integrating Little Rock Central High School is entitled Warriors Don't Cry. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Michael Doris. His book, The Broken Cord, told the story of his adopted son, Abel, who was diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome. Later, Abel was killed in a hit-and-run accident. We'll talk with Doris about the difficulty of writing publicly about personal tragedy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Federal Reserve has increased two key interest rates today. The discount rate has been hiked half a point to 3.5%. That's the first time that rate has been altered in 5 years. The central bank has also moved to boost the federal funds rate by half a point too, to 4.25%. Both actions have begun to drive up borrowing costs for millions of Americans for everything from home mortgages to car loans. The Fed's decision had been widely expected. President Clinton has already reassured Americans that any rate hike won't affect the nation's economic recovery. The Clinton administration has released a new plan to help homeless people eventually move into homes of their own. The plan is estimated to cost $1.7 billion. It suggests that homeless people be taken into short-term emergency shelters, given transitional housing and job counseling. Then, the plan says they should be put in permanent, affordable homes. Veterans Affairs Secretary Jesse Brown was on hand for the plan's unveiling. He pointed to the plight of hundreds of thousands of homeless U.S. veterans.
They are former Marines, soldiers, sailors, and guardsmen. Where they once proudly wore military uniforms, they now wear torn jackets, dirty blue jeans, and old sneakers. Where they once proudly stood and were respected, they are now intimidated and suspected.
The task force report estimates the nation's homeless population reached 7 million people by the end of the 1980s. It says 600,000 people are on the streets any given night of the week. More than 7,500 United Auto Workers are striking several Caterpillar plants in Illinois. The walkout comes just after another strike last week in York, Pennsylvania. Carl Voles of member station WCBU reports from Peoria, Illinois.
Caterpillar says at least 15% of the more than 7,000 strikers have crossed the picket lines. The UAW admits a few have crossed, but the union says the company's estimates are totally false. Caterpillar's Jerry Brust says the UAW has orchestrated the strike, and he says most workers disagree with the union strategy.
We would much prefer to have all of our employees back. We're going to continue to encourage them to come back. But in the meantime, we regret the fact that they're being used by the union for whatever their agenda is.
Rust reiterated Caterpillar's desire to resume negotiations, but he says the union still hasn't responded. The UAW may not respond until Thursday, when the union's Central Bargaining Committee meets in Detroit. For National Public Radio, this is Carl Voltz in Peoria, Illinois.
On Wall Street, stock prices soared today after the Fed announced the rate hike. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 49 points to close at 3,720. Advances led declines by a margin of more than 3-2 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The United Nations says the airport in Tuzla, Bosnia, was hit by two shells today, just after a relief plane landed. The UN plane was a Russian aircraft carrying radar equipment for peacekeepers. It's not clear who fired the shells. No one was hurt. Tuzla, which is held by the Bosnian Muslims, has been designated a so-called safe haven by the UN. The world body has been trying to reopen the airport for more humanitarian aid flights. The French defense minister says that France will withdraw 2,500 troops from the UN peacekeeping force in the former Yugoslavia by the end of the year. But a few hours after he made that statement, the foreign ministry said no final decision has been made for about half of those forces. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
These conflicting statements indicate differences within the French government over the continuing presence of French forces in the former Yugoslavia. France has almost 7,000 troops there, making up the largest contingent. They cost France about $500 million a year. The defense ministry says that's a big price to pay for little results. The defense minister is frustrated by the lack of progress in the peace process and the unwillingness of the United States to put troops on the ground. Foreign Ministry spokesman Richard Duquet confirmed that about 1,200 troops are being withdrawn. He said another 1,200 forces could also be pulled out by the end of the year if there's no significant progress in the peace talks. He indicated that France wants a peace agreement by the end of the year. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Brady handgun law has suffered a setback in federal court. A federal judge in Montana has struck down the law's requirement that local police conduct background checks on prospective gun buyers. The judge says that requirement is unconstitutional. He says it forces local authorities to administer federal law, but the measure's five-day waiting period is still valid. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Michael Doris's new book, Paper Trail, is a collection of personal essays beginning with his own childhood. Doris was raised by a loving and colorful group of women. He's part Modoc Indian, has lived on a reservation, and has written extensively about the problems facing American Indians today. His book, The Broken Cord, about his adopted Indian son Abel, who had fetal alcohol syndrome, won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Abel was killed a few years ago by a hit-and-run driver. Doris's two other adopted Indian children also have fetal alcohol syndrome. The Broken Cord focused attention on the debilitating effects of the syndrome. I asked Michael Doris if he had any hesitations about writing so publicly about private family matters.
The question of whether to write about fetal alcohol syndrome was something that evolved slowly over time. Initially, when I discovered what fetal alcohol syndrome was after basically 10 years of blaming everybody and everything that was curable, from teachers to our lack of early childhood experiences to our own bad parenting for our older son's problems, and finally came upon the scientific study of what FAS was, what happens to a child when the biological mother drinks too much during her pregnancy, I was going to write a kind of scientific article about it. And as I went around the country talking to parents and guardians of these kids, I realized that they were being very open with me and that it would be quite a skewed piece not to reveal that this was our story as well. And so Louise and I sat down with our son and we asked him how he felt about it. And we tried to give him as much informed consent as a person with his limitations could have. And we really, I think, kind of intuited from everything we knew about him, his generosity and his kindness, that if he could have thoroughly understood that by giving up some of the privacy, and we changed his name in the book, that he might prevent somebody else from having the same problems that he had, we were sure he would go with it. And so we made this decision as well. But it's not an easy decision. The Persia, our oldest child, came home from school the other day with a very troubling story. She said that one of the kids in her class had said, "I hear you have an older brother who has learning problems and who died." And it's a very painful subject, of course. And she said, "No, that's not true." And they said, "Oh, yes, it is. My mother read about it in a book." And so she was kind of horrified at having, she thought, done something terrible and denied Abel. And also embarrassed that she would have the burden of this story. Mm-hmm. And so we sat down with her, as we, I think, will with each of our young girls, and tried to explain our reasons for going public with it. And our hope that that by injecting it, not just through the book, but by the television film that was made, into the kind of public discourse that, gee, I heard someplace it might be dangerous to drink while you're pregnant, let's skip this one, that it was Abel's contribution to make.
Did you ever read parts of the book to Abel to understand what you wrote about him and his condition?
Well, he didn't have a real long attention span, but he actually wrote the last chapter himself in his own words, and that made the book whole, I think. It didn't make a big impact on him when the book won a prize and was going to be made into a movie. He was quite removed from all of that. But quite affable about it all the same.
Tell us how Abel died, and he actually was working outside the home and had a job at a restaurant.
Yeah, he had a job as a dishwasher at a truck stop, and all of his life he had seizures, and in his early 20s, he had two brain surgeries that did this complicated operation that separates the hemispheres so that he would just have seizures on one side and not fall down. And it was actually going fairly well for him. It's a strange thing. He was in as good a situation as he could possibly be in. He was in a place that he liked. He was close by to us. He had a job he understood. And his seizures were less. And one dark night, he was crossing a street and was hit by a motorist who was not paying attention.
So it was the motorist's fault.
I'm sure it was. There was not an investigation, but, you know, when you have a disabled child, there are some things you teach them really well. And Abel was a tremendous street crosser. He would wait for a green light to turn red and then go green again before crossing because it was one of those things that we just pounded in over and over and over.
Did the motorist stop?
Not for a long time, actually. And we never heard from her. And, you know, she said that he had darted in front of the car and because he was known by the police to have learning problems, they simply accepted her word for it, but we didn't.
How long did it take to find out who it was?
It took about 12 hours.
So she drove on?
She drove on, and then she stopped, and then she came back to inquire about it, and then she went on. And you know, it was one of those things that I'm sure it was an accident, but and she was not a bad person, but I would imagine she would have felt better if she had ever made contact with us and achieved a kind of peace about it.
Well, I can't imagine as a parent anything more tragic than having a child die before you do. I mean, it seems to almost break whatever that unwritten law is all about. I wonder with Abel and all the problems he had to overcome whether you had ever prepared yourself for the fact that he might not live his full lifespan.
No, I absolutely had not. I think it's one of those unthinkable things that we don't think. You know, when he had his brain surgeries, and I certainly worried about him a great deal, but he was healthy and strong physically in many respects, and certainly nothing life-threatening. So no, I don't. And he was such a vivid personality that he inhabits our dreams often. Mm. And this kind of person he was. Whenever we dream about him, he's happy. Mm. And it's always something that when we wake up, we feel good about that. And it's a blessing, actually. But it's the way he would have been.
He hung on for a couple of weeks after being
He hit never by. Regained consciousness, yeah.
But you were with
yeah,
him?
Yeah.
You talked to him?
Sure.
What'd you say?
Well, I apologized for all of my many failings. And I, for so many years, Abel was the kind of person that didn't really know what to say to abstract questions. And so for years, I would put words in his mouth when people would ask him an abstract question. I would say this and say that. And so I probably did the same thing in those conversations. But he was just a rather extraordinary person, which makes it appropriate that the contribution that he would have made, I think, in life had he not been inhibited by this terrible scourge over which he had no control. His mother drank antifreeze, actually, while she was pregnant, but it doesn't take that much. I mean, for some women, even a few drinks can be dangerous. But this is his contribution, this information to the world.
I'm speaking with Michael Doris. His new book is a collection of essays called Paper Trail. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with writer Michael Doris. Well, you write about Abel two things which I think really resonate with parents. Both, you said that you both underestimated and overestimated his abilities. I think parents do that no matter who or what their children are. And you also write that, with Abel you believe that love and nurturance could make him right. Again, I think a very natural parental impulse. You have a whole bunch of kids. Did you feel that more intensely with Abel than with your other children?
I think you always feel more protective of the most disabled person, you know, because you don't want to see anybody hurt. All our other kids, our little girls in particular, experience the normal ups and downs. Persia came home from school the other day, and the little her friend, her best friend in life, had just turned into a snake, as 10-year-old girls sometimes do. And I just wanted to go and bawl out her parents for having such a terrible child who disappointed my daughter. But this is something that, right. that isn't the normal run of things. Abel never had a call. He never got a call from a friend. He never understood what chumming around would be, or what being curious in the library would be, or what watching a film all the way through. And so you want to find something that makes him happy. And for years, I thought that what was my role is to include him in everything and always get him dressed up nicely and make him very polite and take him out whenever we went to dinner and all of this kind of stuff, and basically insisting that people accept him as he was. And it took me a very long time to realize that he didn't enjoy that one bit. He would much rather stay home in his room with a tape on and reading Garfield cartoons. And
you didn't want him to do that. Well, you wanted him to be in the world?
I wanted him to, talk politics. You know, I wanted him to be all the things that I hadn't had the chance to be when I was growing up, as any parent does. But I think we all have to eventually accept our children as who they are. We should, at least. I think it's sometimes
hard.
A lifelong struggle. And enjoy them for that. And it when he finally got to be himself and was not being shoved into the mold that I insisted he be in, he became, I think, a happier person.
And that's the Abel you dream about?
Oh, you know, he had a real goofy smile. That's the Abel I dream about.
You have two other children also affected by fetal alcohol syndrome, although I get the feeling not quite as deeply as Abel was affected.
The thing about fetal alcohol syndrome is if the best way to be affected, oddly enough, for most people is severely, because then society deems you disabled. If you have an IQ under 71, you qualify for certain services and assistance and educational benefits. And if you are within the normal range of IQ, but you have these problems with understanding right and wrong, with abstract thinking, with understanding consequences of an act, society labels you a sociopath or a thug or a bum, and basically throws you away.
Is that what society's done with your two other kids?
They're both in prison.
They're both in prison?
Yeah.
For what?
For terrible crimes against people that come out of anger and frustration and simply the inability to be empathetic or empathic with the victims of their acts. It's a very common circumstance for fetal alcohol affected people. I've been asked to talk to groups of judges who see more and more people come before them in committing things called conscienceless crime, which make no sense. Killing somebody over stealing a piece of gum and then going out and chewing the gum, not even running away. I was also asked to talk to a group of public defenders who deal with death row inmates, who said that a disproportionate number of their clients were probably fetal alcohol affected. The man who kidnapped the little girl in Petaluma, California, is making a fetal alcohol defense, saying that he didn't know any better because his mother drank during her pregnancy. And that may or may not be true. I think that there are a lot of crimes committed without understanding, and that doesn't automatically lead to a conclusion of what society should do about it except to prevent it from ever happening.
How then, I can see that this issue of fetal alcohol syndrome is still a very live issue for you, one that you still feel very passionate about. Have you resolved that question about how and when you intervene in a woman's life who is pregnant who is drinking, and what responsibility you have to that child, you meaning society, and to that woman's right, of course, to make her own adult choices.
It's one of those terribly conflicting issues of conflicting rights. I think that there are several questions that have to be asked. Is this a pregnancy that is going to go forward? You know, I mean, is it going forward out of choice? If it is going forward out of choice, has the woman had access to good prenatal care? Is she capable of understanding the consequences? Because I think many mothers of FAS kids are themselves victims of FAS and consequently can't make a projection in the long term about what might happen if they do this today. If all those conditions are met and she can't understand, she herself is mentally impaired, then I think if the support network isn't there, if her partner or her parents or her sisters or brothers or children can't help her, and if she has already had an FAS child, I mean, that's – I'm giving you basically the criterion
Absolutely.
That the Lakota tribe uses in intervening. And they are an independent sovereignty, and so they can make their own decisions about such things. But if a woman has had an FAS child, which means that her body does not process ethanol efficiently, the chances are, if she continues to drink, chances are like 95% that another child will also be impaired and even more severely. So if she has had an FAS child, she continues to drink, she can't be counseled out of it, there is no support network. At some point, the tribe insists that she be admitted to a detox center for a period of time.
They, in a sense, walk her to the
Yes.
The center.
Because there, in some communities in that particular place in South Dakota, it's estimated that a third of the children born are born impaired from alcohol use prenatally. And there's no money to care for them. Almost never does an FAS child stay with their biological parent. Very, very rarely. And not only that, a woman who has given birth to fetal alcohol-affected children tends to not live very long herself because of the problems that is symptomatic. And so, in a sense, it's a protective act of someone who can't understand. Now, that, I think, is a very small percentage. Mm-hmm. And most, maybe 7,500 people a year are born with full FAS. It's much more something like 80 or 90,000 a year who are born with fetal alcohol effect, which is a partial set of symptoms. And I think that is much more likely the case that a person who is simply not informed might continue to drink or doesn't have access to prenatal education and care. And those are things that society can certainly work on without any intrusion on rights, just making information available.
We'll talk more with writer Michael Doris in 1 minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered and some of the stories they'll be covering today. Noah, what news on the financial front?
Hi, Marty. The Federal Reserve Board here in Washington is pushing up the key discount interest rate from 3% to 3.5%. The Fed is trying to hold the rate of inflation down in the country. The Clinton administration is announcing a $1.7 billion plan to help the homeless get into homes. Laura Kanoy has a report on the government's new food labeling law and how that's working. And I'll have a conversation with John Grisham, the second most famous writer to come out of the small town of Oxford, Mississippi. The first, of course, being the man they called Mr. Bill, William Faulkner.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. I'm speaking with Michael Doris. His book, The Broken Cord, was about his adopted son, Abel, and Doris's own struggle to understand the debilitating effect fetal alcohol syndrome had on Abel. Doris's new book is a collection of essays called Paper Trail. The material I got about you describes you as Modoc and Irish and French. Which one do you identify with most?
I think all. Irish and French are pretty far back, and I think that's just American, just sort of general American. Yeah. But I did grow up partly on reservation and partly not on reservation, and And on the one hand, it makes for a kind of schizophrenic background, being mixed blood. But on the other hand, it's great to be for a writer, because as a person who lives a little bit on the outside of things, you have to observe very closely to see how people on the inside operate. You always kind of want to be one thing or the other very clearly. But for an anthropologist, mm-hmm. which I was for a long time, or for mm-hmm. a writer, it's a skill and that is important to develop.
Let me pick up on something you said earlier about being an outsider, and certainly many writers talk about that being on the outside, of course, has some lonely attributes, but it also gives you a kind of perspective that insiders don't have. And this is reading from one of your essays. Unpopular is too kind a word to describe my status, and this is when you were a little boy. I was the kind of kid who wore glasses from the second grade on and never took them off, the kind who got his homework in on the day it was due, sometimes typed, the kind who could not catch a ball even when it fell into his baseball glove. Everyone I knew seemed to be part of groups whose doors were closed to me, so I had plenty of time to daydream, to imagine traveling to far-off places, meeting interesting, exotic people, being appreciated for the fascinating individual I was sure I was. Do you still feel like an outsider now? You've had a fair amount of acclaim. People read you all over the place, from Glamour to the New York Times to Mother Jones. You're more of an insider now, aren't you?
Oh, I can't complain. I really can't complain. I am so fortunate in the hand of cards that life has dealt me. But I think along that line, you look around at the interesting people that one knows in life, and didn't they all have miserable childhoods
Absolutely.
Or adolescences or something? I mean, all those people who we admired so much and wished we were when we were in high school, I don't know what they're doing today, but I don't find them among my circle of friends so much. Somebody said, hi, I'm the president of the student council. You know, I'm sure they're all just great. But probably, and undoubtedly it's true, their lives were complicated by success in ways that we, looking enviously at them, didn't quite recognize.
And do you get manuscripts on time into your publisher? And have you continued?
Typed yes.
And
typed,
everything?
Still typed.
But you're saying that the condition of your childhood made you a writer.
I think the condition of my childhood made me reflective, made me thoughtful. I had time on my hands to think about what was important to me, because I was certainly not sought after. And I look upon that, and I try and tell my children when they're feeling slighted by their friends that this is a time to take advantage of, rather than to simply brood about. Mm. That's a hard sell, actually, when you're a kid. But I think one looks back at those times and you remember the moments of self-discovery and reading a book that you just were stunned by. And they're the formative moments.
Well, Michael Doris, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Michael Doris's new book is called Paper Trail. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Nancy Greenlease, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
10 years ago, writer Reynolds Price had what he calls a midlife collision with cancer and paralysis. Now he's written about it in the new memoir, A Whole New Life, An Illness and a Healing. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Reynolds Price. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and I hope you'll join us.